from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. One in eight American adults is an alcoholic. That's according to a study published in the medical journal JAMA Psychiatry this month. The study found that rates of high-risk drinking and alcohol use disorder have increased substantially since 2001 and constitute a public health crisis. We'll discuss what may be driving Americans to drink more, what treatments are most effective, and who's most at risk. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. A new study published this month in the medical journal JAMA Psychiatry has found that the rate of alcoholism among American adults has risen by 49% since 2001, a rate the study authors say points to a growing public health crisis. According to the study, one in eight American adults meets the criteria for alcohol use disorder, which includes both alcohol abuse and alcohol dependency. And it found that problem drinking increased in particular among women, racial minorities, and the poor. This hour, we discuss the study's findings and we'll look at what might be driving Americans to drink more, what treatments are more effective, and what can be done to stem the rising rate of alcoholism nationally. We're going to have a couple of professionals with us to talk about this. But first, we're going to go to Maryland and welcome Dr. Bridget Grant, who is a senior epidemiologist with the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism. And she's the lead author of the alcoholism study. And Bridget Grant, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to begin by saying that these numbers are massive and the rise is really very disturbing. It is a public health crisis by these numbers. But since alcoholism has no real diagnosis, how do you determine who really fits into this category?
Well, I mean, we do assess people in this survey using the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders diagnostic criteria. So these are people that would meet that definition of an alcohol use disorder.
And you do a lot of face-to-face interviewing, and you do other methodology that perhaps you could clue us into?
Yeah, well, in this particular survey, we always do face-to-face interviews with a representative sample of the United States. And it was over 40,000 in the first wave in 2001 and 2002, and around 36,000 in 2012, 2013.
But these are staggering numbers. You're talking about 16.6 million Americans who fall in this category. And again, the rise is almost 50% since the turn of this new century. Roughly, the percentage of those who are seeking treatment is like a bit over 1%. Is that right?
No, it's 10%.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
10%.
1.3 million. I'm looking at the numbers again.
Yes, it's very, very low.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in the course of this hour, about how that can be remedied, though a lot of it is stigma. And a lot of the alcohol problems and difficulties that you point to in the study, I think you said, you point to coping, using alcohol as a coping mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that the 2008 recession had a lot to do with causing a lot of distress and despair, and particularly among minorities and the elderly over 65 years. Because although we had increases across the board in both high-risk drinking and alcohol use disorders, the increases were most notable for women, minorities, and the elderly.
Yeah, the elderly, I'm looking at your figures here, 106.7% increase for 65 and older. And these are people with more pre-existing conditions medically and more disorders and more medication.
Right. Yeah, and that's what makes it so bad, is that many of the chronic diseases that the elderly do contract are alcohol related. In other words, alcohol and heavy drinking would be an important risk factor for many, many chronic diseases.
But there are a lot of people who are, you mentioned economics and certainly people under stress and using as coping and so forth. But we did a whole hour on the opioid epidemic, and there seems to be at least some correlation here between just people in general despair.
Well, I think that, you know, the Deaton article, I guess, has gone on. But, you know, we have a theory in epidemiology that came out in the 1960s, and it's basically the transition theory. And as we, as diseases in developing countries, as we eliminate infectious diseases, then we should see an increase in chronic diseases, and then modern medicine will lead to decreases in chronic illnesses. And then what we should be expecting to see since the 90s is an increase in what we call lifestyle diseases. So that's exactly what we're seeing.
Well, it certainly is dramatic. And Dr. Grant, I thank you for your work and thank you for joining us this morning on the Forum program.
All right. Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Bridget Grant, senior epidemiologist with the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism. She joined us from Maryland. She's the lead author of the Alcoholism Study. I want to get into the nuances and depth of understanding this and understanding what can be done. And Anna Lemke is joining us. She's associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University Medical Center and author of Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. And Anna Lemke, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Bruce Lee Livingston, who joins us here in studio this morning, Executive Director and CEO of Alcohol Justice, which is an alcohol industry watchdog group. Welcome, Bruce Lee Livingston, back to Forum. It's been many years. Good to have you back.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And Bruce, let me begin with you just by talking about how much advertising plays into this, because it plays a very considerable role.
Yeah, I would add to the personal note about why people might be drinking the fact that we have, much like in the opioid epidemic, we have global corporations that are leading the way through advertising and marketing and creating special products that are designed specifically for minority communities, for women, for youth. And it's pervasive. I could wager anyone that a child will know far more beer products than they will know the names of presidents.
And it's cheaper. Alcohol is cheaper than it was ever since 1950. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, alcohol is far too cheap in this country. We need to tax it at more significant levels. We've had efforts at getting mitigation fees passed in California that came up with nothing so far. And it's just grossly underpriced. Some places like Scotland have seriously considered minimum pricing on alcohol products, so that that's a nice windfall for the companies. But it could lead to far less drinking. It is the number one best buy recommended by the World Health Organization, is to raise the price of alcohol. And in this country, that's primarily done through taxes.
And you mentioned the targeting of specific communities. I just want to get some more figures in here. According to the study, which we talked about in the beginning, 92.8% of African Americans, the increase in terms of alcoholism since 2001, 81.5% increase of those between 45 and 64, and of course, young people, and particularly young unemployed people, increasing as well. There is, Anna Lemke, another study, though, and I want to get your thoughts about this, another national survey of drug use and health study that shows that alcoholism actually is in decline, although their numbers say that it's going to be far surpassing the numbers that were seeing in this first study. I'm not sure how we can correlate these two studies, or for that matter, the Distilled Spirits Council, which says that the whole JAMA article is wrong.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how to reconcile that National Survey of Drug Use and Health with these NESARC's data either, except that I do think, you know, what you pointed out earlier on, that you said there's no real diagnosis. I think what you know, the distinction that's important to make is that there are no blood tests or brain scans to diagnose alcohol addiction, or for that matter, any other mental illness. We really rely on phenomenology. And what that means is that we just look at behavior patterns. So these surveys, although this is a very well-done survey, at the end of the day, what it comes down to is asking people about their behavior. And we know that that can be, you know, incredibly biased for all kinds of reasons. For example, it could be that this current survey is showing higher rates because people are more comfortable talking about how they use alcohol than they were 10 years ago. So these are just sort of inherent biases in any survey study. I do think one really compelling data point in this JAMA study is that instead of asking more qualitative questions like, you know, does alcohol get you into trouble with significant others or at work, they actually asked the quantity of drinks per day. And they found that the number of men and women drinking in what we would consider engaging in binge drinking, which for men is more, 5 or more drinks per day, and women 4 or more drinks per day, that that number also went up from 10 to 13%. So I think it's believable that people are drinking more. The JAMA study also found that the number of people who are teetotalers went down. So the number of people who just use alcohol at all went up from 65% to 73%. So even if we're not talking about severe alcohol use disorder, it's very clear that more people are drinking more alcohol. And I think that's compelling and something that we need to pay attention to.
And I should add, there's less money for NIH type of research, with prevention especially.
Well, I don't know about that. Is that true? I mean, I think the NIH and NIDA and NIAAA are working hard to get these studies done and to do preventive studies.
I can speak to that.
Okay.
You know,
I just assumed there was less money, but Bruce, yeah?
Well, not yet. We're dealing with the first President Trump budget here, and there was a proposal by Donald Trump for a $7.5 billion cut. It's been reduced to $5.8 billion cut proposal, especially cutting overhead on funded projects and cutting the Global Health Center completely. Fortunately, the House actually seems to be moving in the right direction, and they've proposed a 3% raise in the NIH budget. So there is hope on that end. We fought similarly cutbacks to the ONDCP and Drug-Free Communities budget in the White House. And that's been taken back. So the cuts are very serious, and especially at a time when we're talking about an opioid epidemic and increased use of marijuana throughout the country, and this great study. I mean, it's actually an astounding number of people that were interviewed. So we're really talking. I think it is very compelling, and it shows where the growth in drinking is. So with these kinds of figures, we really need to be looking at increasing the NIH budget.
Well, agreed. And also, we need to be looking at some signs of hope. And the study does mention that when risk factors are pointed out to young people, there really is some results. And also, obviously, women who are pregnant, there are results as well. But there's still this great stigma with getting treatment. And let me go to you on this, Anna Lemke. I mean, what can be done to reduce that?
Well, you know, stigma is an interesting double-edged sword. On the one hand, you know, stigma is pro-social. If we didn't stigmatize certain behaviors, then there would be, you know, no shame or guilt associated with doing those behaviors. On the other hand, stigma and shame can certainly keep people who are addicted from seeking treatment. So I think it's important to acknowledge that stigma, you know, stigma is hurtful when it comes to getting people resources for their addiction, but that, you know, that stigma is not entirely evil. Like, we need to have boundaries in society. So there are lots of efforts now to destigmatize addiction. One of the most powerful ways to do that is for people to tell their personal stories. Studies show that when physicians, for example, actually meet a patient and learn their journey, they feel much more compassion for that person and for alcohol use disorders and addiction more broadly than if they don't encounter those personal stories. So that's one thing. The other thing that we're trying to do is change the language that we use in addiction. A lot of times we have historically used language like people are clean or their urine is dirty. We talk about alcohol abuse, which sometimes is associated with child abuse. So there's a movement now to eliminate those kinds of terms. And instead of calling it alcohol abuse, we are now calling it alcohol use disorder.
Yeah, there's even some confusion now because of the scrutiny for terminology, as you just pointed out.
Frankly, it's really confusing. because the term addiction, which is widely recognized among most people, is not even in the DSM or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. They don't use that term. And actually, it's a pretty useful term. I like it. But the term addict is considered stigmatized. But if you go to 12-step groups like AA and NA, people self-identify as addict alcoholics. So the language is in huge flux.
Alcohol abuse, alcohol disorder, alcoholism.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
But let's get and do this with you, Bruce Lee Livingston. The health concerns and the costs, because a lot of people have to really face this, especially now with this being a really something that has to be labeled a public health crisis. Certainly the report brings that out more than any report we've seen previously, the necessity of that. And we've got rise in cirrhosis. We've got rise in hypertension. We've got in the year 2010, $250 billion in health costs. And this is just going to continue to rise with these numbers, right?
And those are very conservative estimates. $250 billion a year nationwide is spent on alcohol-related problems. There are 89,000 persons that are dying from alcohol-related causes every year in the United States. In California, that's 10,500 is still the conservative estimate. About 40% of that cost is government cost. So it's a huge impact on our healthcare system, on our highway patrol.
And on our prisons. More and more people going to prison. And the fact there's more fetal alcohol syndrome, which affects children to a great degree, and more what is described as suboptimal child rearing practices. The effects are almost immeasurable, you know, in terms of society and in terms of public health and just public policy necessities, which brings me to something locally that I think I'd like listeners to be apprised of, because there's a lot of political sides to this, too. On your website, you're pointing out Scott Wiener wants the bars to be open later, supervisor here in San Francisco.
Right. I mean, go to alcoholjustice.org. There's action alerts on a number of issues. The power of the alcohol industry is amazing in California. Senator
Wiener,
Scott Wiener.
It's more the bars and stuff.
Right. He wants to open bars till 4 a.m. in special districts that would be kind of party zones. So,
I call him a supervisor. You call him a senator. He's actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, he's actually an assemblyman now.
I'm sorry. He's a senator. he was my supervisor, too. So that proposal is moving forward, unfortunately. It's in the Assembly Appropriations Committee right now, and we're hoping to stop it there. And it's just a bad idea. There's going to be all kinds of local fights on whether these party zones for 4 a.m. will exist in the future in California. Now, we should be talking about restricting retail access and on-sale access at bars and restaurants. We should not be talking about expanding access. And there's been this denigration of controls in California for quite a number of years. And that's along with this increase in alcohol use and abuse by women, African-Americans, Latinos, and older residents who tend to drink till they fall down and hurt themselves and cost a lot of money at the to our healthcare system.
So let me talk a bit with Anna Lemke, who again is associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford's Medical Center and author of Drug Dealer MD, about what can be done to avoid. I mean, you have a whole list of things, and I want to at least give people some heads up on these. Like avoiding people, places, and things that trigger alcohol cravings without, and in many instances, even being aware of it or anticipating moments of vulnerability. But you also talk about how families have to be involved in this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, addiction is a family disease. It's a systems process. And if you don't get that individual's important social network involved, you're really not gonna get traction. People who have addiction progressively isolate from the people around them, and that's part and parcel of their disease process. So it's really important to make sure you bring in the whole system and have everybody work together. And, you know, interestingly, there is this whole concept of codependency, which is a term that comes out of the Alcoholics Anonymous tradition, which basically describes the way in which family members can unwittingly enable their loved ones drinking. So it's really important to get family members involved. I just want to go back to something, though, that Bruce said about restricting access. I think one of the things that is little understood is how important simple access to drugs and alcohol is as a risk factor for developing addiction. We've seen that in full color with the opioid epidemic as doctors began prescribing more liberally. Now we have more people addicted. But it's the same. The same is true for alcohol. As bars are open, later and longer, as alcohol has become more affordable, people are going to use more. And then those individuals who are vulnerable are going to become addicted. So I think we have to really think as a society and individually about binding techniques. And what I mean by that is ways in which we can restrain our own consumption. Because for many of us, when we're in the moment and we have access to that drug or alcohol, we're not able to make the right decision.
So there is a big difference between use and addictive use. And there's a whole spectrum here, I think, that people have to keep in mind, mild alcohol use as opposed to what might be characterized as abusive or over-the-top use. But Bruce Lee Livingston, I'm going to get back to more with you, Dr. Lemke, in a moment. But I want to get to the political thing here again, and we're mentioning Senator Scott Wiener. How much really does the alcohol industry play a role in terms of its lobbying and making things even more difficult?
Well, we know that there's over $2 billion annually in the United States in spending on marketing by the alcohol industry. And of course, it's increasingly dominated by monopolies. Anheuser-Busch InBev is the major industrial player. It's based in Europe, but it's actually Brazilian-owned and managed. It's not an American company any longer, even though they have America Beer for Budweiser. But they spend a lot of money on the marketing, but they also spend it on lobbying, on ballot initiatives, on candidate donations. There is this huge area of social media. Bacardi, for instance, just opened up a Snapchat marketing strategy.
Which is a lot of what kids use. Snapchat,
right, yeah. Right. It's kind of irritating for an adult.
What about the wine industry and all this? Because, you know, a lot of people say wine is healthy and so forth, but it's alcohol.
Well, wine is not something that should be prescribed by a doctor. Even at very low usage levels, it contributes to cancer. Breast cancer is one of even at very moderate levels is contributed to by alcohol.
Let me do this because we're coming up on a break. We're talking about the rise in high-risk drinking as a public health crisis, according to a new study, and we do want to hear from you, our listeners. I know many of you would like to weigh in here and have questions or comments for our guests. We spoke earlier with the senior author of the study, and we also have Anna Lemke, who's a associate professor in psychiatry at Stanford, and Bruce Lee Livingston of Alcohol Justice. And you are welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number is available. Let me give it to you. It's 866-733-6786. Join us now at that number and feel free to be part of the program. 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to become part of the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment and post your questions or comments there. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about alcoholism and a new study that shows that there has been a dramatic rise and that it has become a public health crisis. We talked to the lead author of that study, Dr. Bridget Grant, at the beginning of the program, and Anna Lemke is with us, who is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University Medical Center. And Bruce Lee Livingston's here in studio, Executive Director and CEO of Alcohol Justice, which is an alcohol industry watchdog group. I ought to mention that Anna Lemke, let me go to you on this, because, again, you give some, I think, useful metrics. One of them is that good data about what constitutes safe usage of alcohol. And you've got the sense of men having perhaps a couple standard drinks per day and maybe one for a woman. That sum it up?
Yeah, so these are really useful data. And I like them especially because they're not actually linked to the subjective criteria in the DSM. Questions like, are you having trouble with alcohol? Do you feel guilty about how much you're using? Is your use out of control? Those are such subjective questions. But the questions about how much are you actually drinking every day and then linking that to health outcomes has been incredibly useful when having informed discussions with patients. And what we've found out from large epidemiologic studies is that men who drink more than 14 standard drinks per week or more than 4 per occasion, and an occasion is one day, are at much increased risk for all kinds of morbidity and mortality, early death. Women who drink more than 7 standard drinks per week or more than 4 per day are at risk for all-cause morbidity and mortality. The healthiest people in our country are people who drink no more than 2 standard drinks per week. So when I'm having discussions with patients and they tell me, for example, a middle-aged woman tells me she has no more than a couple of glasses of wine per night with dinner, and we count it up and it's actually 14, then I have to tell her, you know, you're actually in a high-risk category. I'm not saying you're addicted to alcohol, but at the current rate you're drinking, you're at really increased risk for end organ damage, including cancers of all variety. You're at increased risk for traumatic accident. You're at increased risk for early death. And then I can counsel that individual, hey, would you be willing to set a goal of no more than 7 standard drinks per week and no more than 1 per day? Because that will put you in what we consider to be the moderate drinking category.
Don't you also recommend periods of enforced abstinence?
Yeah, so typically I will recommend that if somebody is really struggling with risky use. It's good to kind of clean the slate a little bit and have a month of no drinking if they're able to do that. And the reason that we ask for a month is because that's about the minimum time you need to reset the reward pathways in the brain and kind of start over, decrease your tolerance for alcohol. And it also, I just find people will come in with symptoms of depression, anxiety, insomnia. And if they don't drink alcohol for a month, many times all that will get better without me having to do anything else. And it's really kind of an eye-opener for people. Now, having said that, if an individual really has developed an addiction, then just stopping on their own for a month may not be possible.
Let me read some comments before I go to your phone calls. Some pushback from Amanda, who writes, your guests are perpetuating the harmful policy that all drugs are bad. Alcohol and opioids affect different areas of the brain and should have different laws associated with each substance. The access to opioids should not be aligned with access to alcohol. Their public health effect, the public health effect is drastically different. Restricting access to all drugs is not a viable option. I don't hear that from either of our guests, actually. In fact, but let's distinguish this because it's important. There is a real difference between opioids and alcohol, not only in terms of abuse, but in terms of the reasons behind them. And a lot of doctors, unfortunately, have pointed out that they are indeed culpable with the opioid epidemic because of the responsiveness of and the pharmaceutical industry and big pharma and so forth. We've done programs on this. I don't think I need to go over this territory again, but there are certainly differences, and we don't mean to conflate them, I don't think. Let me read some more comments, though. A listener writes, I quit drinking a few years ago for health reasons. I just feel healthier and happier without alcohol. I was recently out to eat with colleagues, and when I ordered a ginger ale, I endured their commentary for a good 15 minutes. They couldn't seem to understand that, no, I am not pregnant, I'm not a Mormon, and I'm not a recovering alcoholic. I'm just a person who prefers not to drink. Our cultural attitude toward alcohol is extremely dysfunctional. And another listener, Sonia, writes, in the last few years, Costco, Safeway, Trader Joe's, and others in my neighborhood have added aisles of alcohol. Clearly, there is more consumption. And here in Marin, kids are drinking at scarily young ages. We have a problem. Comment from Keith, who says, as of 2010, the alcoholism rate in Sonoma County was 15% higher than the state average. We promote alcohol so aggressively in Sonoma County, and for the first time, the county fair this year, people were not only allowed to drink in the main pavilions and Hall of Flowers, but there was beer and wine being served inside these venues. Bruce, when you hear these kind of comments, what's your response?
Well, I think the response should be that we need to reduce the environmental access to alcohol. And in this state—
Maybe change the culture, too?
Change the culture. That's part of it. Is let's stop letting kids see alcohol advertising on billboards. And we eliminated alcohol advertising from billboards that are on public property in Muni, BART, and the city of Los Angeles. And so there have been successes. But one thing I wanted to get to was the fact that we this kind of social marketing that's taking place, every celebrity wants to get their own alcohol brand. Cable TV does not have federal controls over advertising in the same way that the 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. period used to have on broadcast TV. So on popular TV shows, everybody is seeing alcohol advertising all the time. There's certain products that are marketed to minorities and special to women. The pink products that are marketed to women. Blast by Colt 45 was specifically marketed to African-American young people and promoted by Snoop Dogg and Pabst Blue Ribbon. You have flavored beers, very youth-oriented products, what we call Alka-Pops, flavored malt beverages of all kinds. So it's just there's been this aggressive marketing. So this trend that we've seen from the mid-90s to now in vast increases in consumption and especially increases in populations that were traditionally consuming less, that's very highly associated with aggressive marketing. You can't have a football team or a baseball team advertisement without seeing a beer ad on it. So they're very smart about how they're doing it. And I'm going back to my industry watchdog role, but the industry is promoting it. It's not just individual choices. It's something that it's always in front of you, and we've got to change our cultural attitudes and the environment.
Let me read another comment from a listener. Heidi, who says, I strongly feel as if alcohol abuse can be a symptom of the vast lack of resources for mental health services and treatment. As a person who has a master's degree and work with individuals with developmental disabilities, I have personally experienced trying and failing to get mental health services for my clients and family members and then seeing them turn to alcohol as self-medication. And I think that's an important point and one that I'm sure, Anna Lemke, you recognize and can reinforce. But let me ask you about something else. Go back, if we could, for a moment before we go to our callers, about what we touched on before. We got to get into the terminology here. I mean, can you explain, well, behaviors, for example, associated with alcoholic abuse and alcoholic dependency and what the signs are?
Sure. You want me to talk about the language that we use now versus the old language, or you just want me to talk about the symptoms?
Well, I think we've touched on the language, and I think we've, you know, gotten out the fact that it's very confusing and there's a lot of ambiguity. But there are specific behaviors associated with what at least is characterized as alcoholic abuse and alcoholic dependency and the signs of those behaviors, are there not?
Yes. Yes. So these are the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders criteria. And frankly, there are like 9 or 10 of them, and I can't even remember them half the time. So an easy way to remember them is to think of the 3 C's. The first C refers to out of control use. So an example would be I went to a party, I planned just to have 1 beer and 6 beers later. The second C refers to compulsive use. Compulsive use means that my desire to not use is overwhelmed by a deep-seated habit that compels me to use, and much of my mental real estate is taken up with thinking about using and arranging my life so that I will use. And then finally, the third C is consequences, or especially continued use despite consequences. And I really think this is the hallmark of somebody who's developed a severe addiction to any substance. And that is, despite their relationships falling apart, despite them performing poorly at school or in their professional life, despite legal consequences, they are still unable to stop using the substance. And for me as a physician, this was really eye-opening for me when I began to treat people with addiction, to see people who understood they had an addiction, who wanted to stop, and yet despite that, were really unable to stop without help.
All right. Let me bring our callers in here, and Meetu is first up. Meetu, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Michael. My question is, has anyone studied the correlation between the casual drinking that's shown on the TV programs and our films, and young adults who, you know, take up drinking as a cool habit.
Yeah, what do we know, Bruce Lee Livingston, about the correlation there? I mean, what's seen in movies and what's certainly a part of television scripts and so forth with lots of drinking?
Well, I think we've done a great job on getting tobacco use out of films and television, although kind of the Mad Men sort of phenomena is taking place.
Or go see Atomic Blonde in 1985, everybody's right. Smoking constantly.
But drinking is not being eliminated from film or television or cable. It's proliferating. And there is a correlation there for sure. I would refer you to the center to CAMY, C-A-M-Y. I think it's CAMY.org, the Center on Alcohol Marketing to Youth. And there's been lots of studies on that marketing, and it is very pervasive and it is very effective. If it wasn't effective, the industry wouldn't spend all that money marketing. And there's a lot of product placement that's taking place in videos, in songs even. If you hear a brand name in a song, they probably paid for it to be there. There's music that's actually entirely created by the alcohol industry and promoted to the public.
Sometimes
on
it isn't
media.
Even a specific brand. I mean, I'm thinking about Margaritaville and those kinds of things. I mean, it was a phenomenon that continues.
Well, then Anheuser-Busch InBev takes it and creates
Limeritas. They piggyback off it, yeah.
And Strawberitas, and that is the most popular youth-oriented product out on the market right now.
Here's Alan joining us from Sacramento. Alan, welcome.
Thank you. One of the things that I'm a little puzzled about is that alcohol production and sales in the U.S. is actually fairly easy to track because it's taxed and regulated by the federal government. And the numbers don't seem to be consistent with these alarmist statements about increase in both usage rates and abuse rates. Maybe it's just sloppy terminology. You know, the DSM alcohol abuse definition is very different, as has been noted, than the traditional definition for alcoholism. Maybe reporting is better. But if we have this epidemic that's getting worse at the rate people are claiming, we would see significantly higher rates of alcohol sales, and that's just not happening.
Any comment, Bruce Lee Livingston?
Well, there's a transition in alcohol sales for sure towards wine and spirits, which are much higher alcohol content, and even craft brew is higher alcohol content. This study highlights the fact that there's more abusive use of alcohol. It's not the general consumption, although the percentage of people in the general population, and that's led, of course, by white men, who are using alcohol is increasing, but now these are dangerous indicators of abusive use of alcohol among minorities and women.
But it's an interesting point he makes. If those tax numbers are not that much dramatically higher, how do we correlate this to the epidemic numbers that we keep reading about in the study?
Well, there is a little inconsistency here because there's a slight drop in the use of ethanol or ethyl alcohol in the country. But there's definitely what this study is showing, and it is a huge population that they surveyed, is definitely showing a slide towards the alcohol use disorders and towards binge drinking.
Let me thank Alan for the call. Did you want to comment on this, Dr. Lemke?
Well, I think it's a really good point. I think it's worth looking into. Why is that discrepancy there? One of the trends we're seeing across the country with all addictive substances is that it's not necessarily that more people are consuming the drug, but that the people who are consuming the drug are consuming it more and in more dangerous ways. So I don't know if that could account for the inconsistency, but it could be that there's a subset of people who are using in more moderation, and then a subset of people who are using more dangerously. Like, so that might even things out, but I really don't know, and it's a good point.
Let me read some more points from listeners. This listener writes, I worked at a large tech company straight out of college, was quickly sucked into yet another culture of binge drinking, and there were at least two company-sponsored events offering alcohol each week and often four or five occasions to drink. I went to more than a few meetings drunk or tipsy, and it was a huge part of coping with stress. We should add parenthetically that alcohol does create more stress, but let me go on and read the comment. At the time I quit, my drinking was totally out of control, and I had to stop drinking for nearly a year to get a handle on things. Alcohol and tech are deeply entwined. Joe writes, give me a break. I started drinking wine with formal lunches and dinner when I was a teenager. My entire Italian family did, too. None of us is alcoholic. My partner's family grew up with a cocktail hour before dinner for three generations, and we had a drink or two every night for the last 45 years. So the listener says, so much California agriculture is changing from growing food to growing grapes for wine because it's more lucrative. We need fresh produce more than we need wine. And a comment from Mason, who says, it should not be overlooked that NPR's corporate donors in recent years have included a hard liquor distillery and two or more breweries. KQED is likely sponsored by at least one vineyard. Considering the number of possible corporate donors, it is baffling that NPR and affiliate stations would hawk alcohol. And we'll bring more callers on here. Pat, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. It seems that you've agreed that you've changed the language referring to some of these heavy drinking or light drinking, but have you actually changed other criteria? And the thing I'm interested in most is, has the number of beers that a beer drinker drank in 2000 increased to today? I mean, I haven't seen that actually spoken to, and it seems like you've actually said that that hasn't happened. You haven't seen an increase in consumption among the people who are drinking back then to now.
Ed Olemke, get you on record here.
Yeah, so this study does show that the number of people who drink any alcohol at all has gone up from 65% to 73%. Let me just pause there and say it's always really interesting to look at how many people don't drink any alcohol, right? It's more than a quarter of the population. But the study also did show that there are more people who drink more per day. So again, we consider a binge to be drinking more than five standard drinks per day for a man, more than four or more for a woman. And that number also went up. So I think that the answer to your question is that this study did look at that. And it did find that people, that there is a larger proportion of the population, 13%, who are drinking more drinks per day when they do drink.
How do we explain the gender inequity? I mean, just the fact that men have... No, go ahead.
A very interesting change over the past couple of generations is that the number of men with an alcohol addiction compared to the number of women used to be 2-to-1. So there were more, twice as many men who had an alcohol addiction as women. And that was true for decades. In the last 30 years, that has changed substantially. And now we have men and women almost equal in their rates. And we've seen this incredible telescoping of the number of women who now are drinking large amounts of alcohol and who are meeting criteria for alcohol use disorder or addiction. So that's been a huge, huge change in the past 30 to 40 years.
And here's another caller. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. Yes. The question was regarding the number of drinks either per day or per week. And I was listening to that and I was wondering, you know, I will go to a party and I'll have two, three, maybe four beers, but then I won't drink for the whole week. And then maybe I'll have maybe two drinks over dinner on Saturday, and then I won't drink for another 4 or 5 days. So the measure of the number of drinks per week or per day seems kind of fuzzy. How do I account for whether it's too much or not too much?
Can you help this gentleman, Anna Lemke?
Sure. So, Joe, if you're drinking less than 14, so if you at the end of the week add up everything that you drank in the week, and by the way, we consider one standard drink to be one 12-ounce bottle of beer, one 5-ounce glass of wine, or 1.5 ounces of hard liquor. So that's how we measure a standard drink. And if you add that up and discover that you had no more than 14 drinks per week, so all combined, and no more than four drinks per occasion, then you're in what we consider to be a healthy or moderate drinking range. Again, the healthiest people in this country drink no more than 1 to 2 standard drinks per week. But if you're not drinking more than 14 per week and not more than 4 or 5 per occasion, then you're doing just fine.
We're getting interesting questions along the lines of sort of calibrating how much alcohol is still safe or doesn't qualify someone to be considered abusive with alcohol. Here's a listener who says, should menus and containers be required to display the number of standard drinks? By my calculation, just one Imperial 20-ounce pint of 7.8 IPA is about 2.5 standard drinks. you want to comment, Anna?
Yeah. So, you know, that is, for example, here on the Stanford campus, one of the policies that we've now initiated over the last couple of years is that at parties where there are sanctioned alcohol consumption, we have cups that actually indicate how many standard drinks in order to help people track that. So it is important for people to know, whoever the caller is, I don't remember the name, you must be good at math because you were able to figure out, you know, the percentage of alcohol. So that matters too, the percentage of alcohol, you know, and then the volume. But it is, you know, one standard drink is usually considered to be 14 grams of ethanol, which again usually corresponds to one 12-ounce bottle of beer, one 5-ounce glass of wine, or 1.5 ounces of hard liquor.
And here is Erica. Erica, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for this topic today. It resounds with me very personally. Both my mother and my father are alcohol users, and they have been for decades. I grew up with it. But the thing for me is you've commented on the three C's, and I think that those are incredibly important. But I will say that both of my parents are very successful in their careers. They, when they're in social situations, it seems as though they can control themselves. But what I've seen behind the scenes as a child is that in secret, there are very different behaviors. And so I just want to make the comment that it's very important to look at the hidden signs and the behind the scenes that we may not notice.
It's a very important comment, Erica. And I think probably Dr. Lemke would agree that, I mean, there's a lot of secret drinking and secret behavior.
Oh, gosh, is there ever. And thank you so much for having the courage to share that. You know, addiction has no boundaries. And it crosses all social strata, and people can get very good at hiding it, and people can function at a very high level, and no one ever knows, except for maybe the people closest to them, which gets back to one of the original points that Michael brought up, which is why it's so important to bring family members in. If I, as a psychiatrist, sit with a patient and ask them about their drug and alcohol use, they may tell me a very different story than if I ask their spouse or their child or their parent. So it's really important to get multiple data points.
And Bruce Lee Livingston, let me read a comment from a listener. I'd like to get your reaction to it. Kiana writes, I disagree that hiding and limiting alcohol from consumers will lessen the alcohol addiction rates. The more we normalize light casual drinking, exposing children to a healthy non-binge drinking culture, it will allow them to carry on healthy drinking practices. It should not be stigmatized. Why can't I have an open container, beer or Togo wine, while I walk my dog? Is it too much, so much worse than an energy drink or soda?
Yes, it is so much worse. Unfortunately, I've seen, even in my house in Bernal Heights here in San Francisco, I've seen groups of young people walking with their red cups down the street as a kind of a group project or running and drinking. We need to reduce that environmental access, that viewing of alcohol in public places. We should not have our stores covered, plastered with alcohol advertising on every street corner. Alcohol should not be sold next to candy at stores. It should be a little farther away from the cash register. Even Safeway now, they've got moonshine in little mayonnaise-like containers that are incredibly high proof that are right next to the cash register. So for impulse buy and for stealing for kids. It makes a big difference to reduce the visual effect of seeing alcohol everywhere. It makes a big difference for kids, and we should reduce the availability and increase the price.
Here's Jane, the new mother, Jane, huh? Congratulations.
Yes. Well, thank you. I have actually two kids, 2 and 4, and I want to talk about something slightly different, which is I grew up in India and where alcohol consumption as a mother was looked down upon. But I feel since I moved here about 10 years ago and went to grad school, that's where my drinking started, and it was encouraged, and, you know, people used to drink a lot at parties. When I got pregnant, the drinking continued a little bit, you know, and I was under peer pressure to drink more and more to become more interesting. Even as a new mother, I'm not saying that I drank a lot, But, you know, as a mom, there is, I feel in our society, I live in San Francisco, there is sort of a pressure on us to, oh, if you're stressed out, drink a glass of wine and you'll feel better. And I gave into that, but unfortunately or fortunately for me, that I grew sort of an allergy to alcohol and I had to completely go cold turkey, so I don't drink anymore.
You have a perfect excuse.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm surprised that it is so acceptable, encouraged, and sort of, you know, people cheer me on when they see me drinking as a new mom of little kids, and they're like, whoa, you know, oh, you are so fun.
I think you've, Jane, described the peer pressure here, even for pregnant women, that is so extraordinary. And I appreciate, again, your candor and the honesty and candor of so many who have called in over the course of the hour or written in. I'm also looking at, we're coming up at the end of the hour. A listener wants to know how alcoholism rates compare in places like Germany and France and Italy, where beer and wine are so tied to culture and food. Anybody have any idea? Anna or Bruce?
Well, the drinking rates, we have very different laws from state to state and in different nations. And the drinking rates in Europe are extremely high, even with higher beer. But they have an 18-year-old drinking age, which is ridiculously low. So there's a lot of problems in regulation there.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground on this study. I want to express my appreciation not only to you, our listeners, for chiming in with your thoughts and questions, but to our experts who are here with us, Bridget Grant, who is senior epidemiologist, who joined us at the top, the lead editor of, or excuse me, author of this study, and Anna Lemke. Again, her book is Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. She's associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Stanford's Medical School. Thank you for joining us this hour, Anna Lemke.
Oh, it's a great to be here.
And thank you, Bruce Lee Livingston, Executive Director and CEO of Alcohol Justice and Alcohol Industry Watchdog Group. Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks, KQED and Michael.
And another hour coming up, we're going to talk all about the mission and its art and its politics. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.